You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at wearelibertarians.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
About a mile off the Northumbrian coast in the year 793, monks went about their daily routines in a monastery on the island of Lindisfarne. Unfortunately for the monks, this was not going to be a regular day. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle reads, "In this year, fierce foreboding omens came over the land of the Northumbrians, and the wretched people shook. There were excessive whirlwinds, lightning, and fiery dragons were seen flying in the sky. These signs were followed by a great famine, and a little after those, that same year, on the 6th Ides of January, the ravaging of wretched heathen men destroy God's church at Lindisfarne." A scholar who was in Charlemagne's court at the same time described, "Never before has such a terror appeared in Britain as we have now suffered from a pagan race. The heathens poured out the blood of saints around the altar and trampled on the bodies of the saints in the temple of God like dung in the streets." The monastery at Lindisfarne was founded about 160 years earlier in the 630s by St. Aidan, who came from Ireland as a missionary to the Anglo-Saxons. In 685, the great St. Cuthbert spent his final years at the monastery as the bishop of Lindisfarne. The island, which today is called the Holy Island, was decimated by Viking raids on that day in 793. This raid marks the beginning of a new era in Anglo-Saxon history, the Viking Age.
Welcome to the History of Modern Politics. My name is Chris Spangle. That voice that you heard is Matt Whitliff. And today we are discussing the Vikings and the King of the English, a major development in the history of Britain. Here on the History of Modern Politics, this is episode 6, but if you are hearing this in the free feed, there are all kinds of episodes 7, 8, 9, 10 are already available at historyofmodernpolitics.com or to We Are Libertarians Plus members. So please go check that out and make sure you sign up. You'll also get show notes, our reading lists, which are... Matt, it takes me as much time to put together the reading lists as it does to edit the episode. So there's tons of resources. This is a guide, and the History of Modern Politics is a guide to help you understand how our modern politics developed through the lens of Britain initially. And our goal is basically just to give you the highlights of history and then help you to take those reading lists and move on to study the things that interest you. And this era is one of my favorites, and Alfred is someone that interests me, and the Viking Age, I think, is very interesting. Mm-hmm. And, Matt, it's so interesting that Netflix made a TV show called The Last Kingdom out of it, which we both enjoy, and many people, I'm surprised at how many people know that show, and that this kind of tells you the history of that entire series.
Yeah, we're going to be right square in the middle of it. I think we'll reference a couple places of how it aligns to episodes in The Last Kingdom here as we go through things today. And so we're covering the era where we left off in Britain in episode 4. So we'll pick up the dates from about 825 only through 935. We're only going to cover about 100 years here today as our episodes kind of continue to go through time now. The time span that we'll cover is going to be a little bit shorter, but, you know, we've got the legacy of, you know, one of the most famous English kings, Alfred the Great, here today.
Isn't it funny that 100 years in our world like feels in our lifetime feels like forever, but when you're talking about history, it's just, this is only 100 years. You know, the last episode we did 500.
Yeah.
Now, why is this era important, Matt?
Well, you know, first we're going to cover the legacy of Alfred the Great, right? And he's, quote, you know, the great for a reason. His political, religious, educational, legal reforms all really helped mature the Kingdom of England into, first of all, a Kingdom of England, and out of those clan-based tribal societies that we've kind of talked about that emerged, you know, kind of evolved into the Heptarchy. You know, you had kings and over kings and things like that, and you know, we're not like squarely 100 years here before this in true tribal nature, but But Alfred takes it kind of the next quantum leap forward, and probably more importantly, also his sons and grandsons, right, really cement the infrastructure, if you will, that Alfred starts to put into place. But he did have one major thorn in his side, Chris, and that is our friends, the Vikings.
Yeah, the Danes or the Northmen. They come from Scandinavia, which is, as we discussed in episode 4, the homelands of the Germanic tribes. So the Angles, the Saxons, the Franks, the Goths, the era that historians refer to as the Viking Age, runs from 793, Lindisfarne, to 1066, the Battle of Hastings, when the Normans come in and completely change everything. While the bookends of this era align to historically British events, in this episode we'll see the impact of Scandinavians in both Britain and France. So we're continuing on when the native British call for help when they're being attacked by Vikings. The Anglo-Saxons move in, and that just kind of continues. People from the interesting thing about Britain, Matt, is that the Norsemen and the Franks from the south and the even Spaniards, what would be Spain today, like all move into Britain. It's a rich area of resources that kind of have these convulsions, and the 1066 is the delineator between the tribes and then just we'll get to the Normans, but they're psychos. they're the worst of them all, and they really like solidify power. But this is the beginning of those threads. So let's start with Ecgbert and pick up from episode 4, where we had the Bretwald to Ecgbert of Wessex, who ended the Mercian supremacy. So tell us a little bit more about how this all started to develop in 825.
Yeah. I mean, if you remember from episode 4, you know, Mercia, the area kind of in central England, as you think about it today, or central Britain, that was really the power center. But Ecgbert defeats the Mercians in battle in 825 and kind of creates overlordship of the rest of England at that point. That's the concept of the Bretwalda. And however, it didn't last that long. a couple of years later, the Mercians, kind of regained that independence. And, kingship wasn't fully hereditary yet at this time, but Ecgbert was able to make the right alliances and deals and secures the throne for his son, Ethelwulf, in 839. And with that alliance, Ethelwulf is controlling both Wessex, which is in the south and west, if you recall, and Kent, which is over in the southeast. And so his oldest son is given Kent to kind of rule as a sub-kingdom immediately. And then a few years into his reign, his daughter is given to marriage to the king of Mercia to try to continue to form and cement some alliances and strengthen relationships. And interestingly, and I think this is a theme we'll see through the next episodes, I mean, we think about the Dark Ages as a time where, people are just living in like huts and there's no communication or things like that. But no, I mean, King Ethelwulf goes to Rome in 855. I mean, the concept of pilgrimages, you'll see sprinkle out here throughout the next two episodes, because there are people traveling all across the territory that were, all across Europe and into Jerusalem and places like that.
Oh yeah, 500 years almost before Christopher Columbus, the Vikings were landing in, Northern America. You have tin that is from Britain, in the south of Britain, in parts of ancient Greece. And in ancient Greece, there's British tin. And so you have a large amount of movement even in ancient times. So we call it the Dark Ages because we don't have a lot of written record, which we'll see Alfred start to correct in this episode. But that doesn't mean that human movement stops. People who exist before the 1200s, basically, when you really start to get a lot of written records, still are moving and convulsing and traveling and exploring and pilgrimaging. So
that's right.
I think that the walk to Rome, through the main part of Europe, wasn't it 9 to 14 days, depending on your weather and your strength?
Sure.
Yeah. And you had all kinds of like little stops and gas stations basically through there. So yeah, this is, even though it's the Dark Ages we're technically talking about, that it doesn't mean that people stop. There is movement.
Yeah. So Ethelwulf has a few sons, and his as we said already, he's given Kent to one of them. He gives his next oldest son, Ethelbald, king the kingdom of Wessex, to kind of rule in his absence. And by this time, I think the oldest is dead. So Ethelbert, another son, is or Barrett is taken as king of Kent. So he had two other younger sons who had actually already been to Rome and spent some of their childhood growing up there. And that connection between England and Rome is, and the Pope and all that is already established. And when Ethelwulf returns to England, Ethelbald refuses to relinquish Wessex. And that causes, we're on the brink of civil war. So he goes ahead and gives up the western part to Ethelbald. He kind of sits in the central part, and Ethelbert has the southeast. And when he dies, this all puts Wessex and Kent back into the control of Ethelbert because, the other son has died. Now we're ready to hit the events of episode 3 of season 1 of The Last Kingdom with Ethelbert ruling until his death of 865. And now we've got to figure out who's going to be the next king.
So none of Ethelwulf's sons so far had any children. So the next oldest, Ethelred, is selected as the next king. Now he dies in 871. Which puts us into the Last Kingdom, like Matt said. And unlike the TV show, there was not a question of succession. There was no other male heirs to make a claim. So the crown passed to Alfred easily. So always be careful. Like, I don't know, but when I watch these shows, I'm always Googling the history. And the Last Kingdom is fairly terrible when it comes to true history. So the crown passes to Alfred. He's the fifth and the youngest son of Ethelwulf, who should be called the father of kings or something.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, so once you start the reign of Alfred the Great, if you've watched that, from our opening, the number one issue facing Alfred's reign is the Vikings. And there's a lot of challenges in this period, and the Vikings are one of them. They're called the Great Heathen Army. There is not to plug an other podcast, but historyhit.tv has a lot of great podcasts, and they just did a great episode on the Great Heathen Army, which I would recommend, and I'll put in the show notes. But the Viking raids start in the last 700s again, and as noted in the opening, continued well into the 800s, growing in size and scale. And the threat under Ethelwulf and his first two successors was limited to raiding and occasional battles. They'd go into churches and they'd steal the wealth that were concentrated in churches mostly. But in 865, the Vikings, referred to the Danes, which encompassed Danes, Swedes, and Norwegians, raised a large army with the intent on settling in Britain. Now, there weren't towns, right? Like, so when we mention Kent, that's in the bottom right of England for the most part. And that's where most of the power was. But, the city of London was still very small. It was less than 5,000 people at this time. So they want to settle in where you can grow food. And that's what they're trying to invade. According to some legends, the army was led by four brothers in a response to the execution of their father by a Northumbrian king. Think England up towards Scotland. From 865 until 878, the Danes were largely successful and gained territory and treasure. Now, Alfred's forces defeated them, Matt, at the Battle of Edington in 878 under the Treaty of Wedmore. The Danes agreed to stay out of Wessex, and their leader, Guthrum, converted to Christianity.
Right. And so this establishes the time or the policy known as the Danelaw, right? So Alfred is able to retain Wessex and the eastern part and the northern part of England is settled and ruled really by these Danish invaders by these Vikings. But you are beginning to see the influence of Christianity already taking hold on the heathens of the Vikings, right? As they slowly start to convert from their Norse pagan religions over into Christianity and try to, with varying degrees of success over the years, cohabitate and coexist with the English.
Yeah. We tend to think that, we have this view of the English and then the Vikings come over and they really meld in together. It's like the Romans. When we talked in previous episodes about former Roman generals becoming, British and British rulers, everybody kind of melds together. It's that melting pot concept. So Alfred continues to rule over Wessex and Kent. Think London over to the right there, with Western Mercia as a sub-kingdom. And this is where Alfred's impacts start to really take place. So in the late 1880s or early 1890s, Alfred published the Doom Book. The word doom comes from the Old English word for law or judgment. So this is really like a book of laws and just kind of codifying what were standards and norms in their culture. Now, Alfred combined the codes of law that came from Ethelbert of Kent, recall him as the royal convert to Christianity in the early 600s, Ine of Wessex from the late 600s and may have simply borrowed from a later version of Kentish law, and Offa of Mercia, the most illustrious of all Mercian kings, Matt, who corresponded with Charlemagne during his rule in the late 700s.
Yeah, we didn't get too deep into Offa, but in episode 4, but he was, in fact, you know, a very powerful Mercian king. And so Alfred combines all of these sources together. He adds in the Ten Commandments and writes, you know, pretty long introductions himself of his kind of view of the law and things like this. So while there had been aspects of written law here and there throughout Britain, this is really a consolidation, a unification, and a big step forward in terms of trying to cement written law into English society.
Yeah, and he put a great value on the notion of justice, and he practiced what he preached when it came to the dispensation of justice and oversight of those who perform justice outside of his court. There's a great book that I highly recommend called Blood Feud, because while we're talking about Vikings, like, invasions always get the most conversation because that was a terrifying thing for the people of the time. So it's what's written about a lot. But for the people living at the time, the more immediate threat was blood feuds. So we've talked about this before, but you're still in a society where you're talking hundreds of people living in a village. You're not talking about cities of tens of thousands. And so you'd have various tribal leadership and they'd war with each other. Or if you're in close contact and you kill somebody's cousin, they're allowed to come and kill you or do what they want with you. And so justice is meted out really by vengeance. And so the blood feuds in this period start to really, like, and this book really does a great job of telling some of those stories by Richard Fletcher. About how much of a threat it is to the cohesion of the kingdom and how intense it is. Even into the 1200s, the death toll, like if you live in London now, 1 in 100,000 people is the death rate. In the 1200s, which is almost double, like, you know, we're in the 800s, the death rate was 50 out of 1,000. In London, it was 100 out of 100,000. So it's, your death rate is incredibly high and violence is incredibly high. And Alfred sees this as a threat and starts to really consolidate the law to administer justice as a way of diffusing the vengeance policies of tribal government and trying to make it more fair. Because just because you think Matt killed my cousin, it doesn't mean that Matt did kill my cousin, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, and the notion of a wereguild, I think, you know, that comes up in the Last Kingdom series, and, you know, it comes from the Germanic heritage of, you know, if you commit a crime or kill somebody, there's a certain amount of payment that you have to give to the family, and sometimes it was pretty hard to make that payment, which if you can't make that payment, then, you know, vengeance often becomes the next best thing.
And there aren't prisons either. Like, if you committed a crime, you paid a fine and you moved on. And that existed till Henry II and the Plantagenets. But there weren't prisons. You got caught stealing. You got your hand cut off.
So. That's right. That's right. And like we said, Alfred practicing when he preached, you know, the king holds kind of the oversight of justice throughout the land. So as he's, giving the right to perform justice to lower officials and things like that, if they don't do it the way that he wants, it's not like he goes and kills them, but he does remove them from their post and really is, like we said, trying to reinforce this notion of justice. So the next big you know, contribution that Alfred makes to history and is promoting the formal use of the English language, right? So the church is in the legal code still remains mostly Latin, but the knowledge of Latin by this time is you know, continuing to decrease even amongst the nobility. And so Alfred makes the steps to set up court schools, schools in his court, right, to teach English. The Doom Book is written in English, and there's a lot of other projects, including his most ambitious project, that is written in English as well.
Should we take like 1 minute to explain what a court is? Because I think this, this, you know, as it starts to develop in this period, it's going to become more common. Tell us, like, briefly, what does it mean to be in Alfred's court?
Yeah, I mean, the court is essentially the household, if you will, within the palace, right? So it's again, not just, I think we talked briefly about this around Charles Martel. It's not like the immediate family of the king, but it's all of his retinue, if you will, right? The people who are helping administer day-to-day operations of the palace. It's people who are, you know, related closely to the royal family. It is often then some of even the high-ranking nobles who are from that same region might also live in the palace. So this entire kind of administrative apparatus of, you know, running the kingdom, if you will, is, you know, quote unquote, the court.
Yeah. And eventually, once we get into the Tudor era and, you know, Louis in the 1600s, they're locking all the nobility up in Versailles, and it becomes a much larger court. And it's basically like Congress of the time, I guess, in some ways. But so this leads us to the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles. So language being centralized, obviously, is a very powerful force, but so is history. And the documentation of the Anglo-Saxons' history was developed through Alfred's court in English, and it serves as an important source of history that survives to this day. It's one of the things that lifts us out of that notion of the Dark Ages. So Alfred had several copies made and had them distributed to monasteries across the realm with instructions for them to continue to add to the chronicles. So if you remember us talking about Bede, he's, you know, it's this very, like, matter-of-fact paragraph about what happened with this ruler, and then that led to this, then that led to this. That's sort of what the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles read like, but it's incredibly important for our view, looking back, to understand what is important, Matt.
Yeah, and several of these manuscripts have even survived to this day. We don't think we've got the original, but, you know, this... sometimes trying to sort out like what version B says versus version F, right, are some of those challenges. But this has been an incredibly important piece of literature that have allowed us to reconstruct a lot of what happened in this era.
So that leads us to the death of Alfred in 899, Matt.
Yeah, and by this time, you know, the Danes are somewhat contained, right? I mean, that doesn't mean there's no fighting. Wessex is now really holding primacy over the rest of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. And Mercia was already under de facto rule by Alfred's daughter, Alphilfled. So her husband, Lord Ethelred, seemed to have been incapacitated with some sort of injury in the early 900s. And Ethelfled is really ruling in her own right and continues to rule even after his death. I mean, I think this is a notable piece of history that, you know, the Mercians don't go off and, you know, find the next lord or sub-king. They allow her to continue to rule as the Lady of the Mercians till the end of her life in 918. And through this time, she's really joining up with her brother, Edward, who's known in history as Edward the Elder, who took on Wessex and the full kingdom of the English as he takes the throne in 899 with the death of Alfred.
So Edward continues in his father's footsteps with victories over the Vikings and further solidifies Wessex as the power base for the, quote, king of the English. And as we noted, this is supported by his sister Ethelfled. Edward's reign continues until his death in 924, and his sons become successive kings through 955, so another 25 years or so. And his son Æthelstan bears special mention as a ruler who best continued the legacy of his grandfather, Alfred the Great. Now, Edward had 14 children. Æthelstan helped arrange dynastic marriages for his sisters to the royal families on the continent, and that gives us, Matt, a good segue to bring people up to speed on the events on the continent across the channel.
That's right. So if we look first at his sixth child and his third oldest daughter, Edgifu, she is married off to Charles the Simple. And this is probably as early as 917. So while Edward is actually still alive. So if you remember at the end of our last episode, episode 5, Charles the Fat was the sole remaining adult male heir in the of Charlemagne, which gave him control of the entire Carolingian Empire. It didn't last long, and it wasn't really due to death. He was considered a weak ruler. He was having troubles of his own in fighting off the Viking raids in France, and seemed to have probably suffered from some ongoing illnesses. So a coup was led against him in 887, which was just 2 years after we left off in the end of last episode when he had the consolidation of the empire. So it's just far too much detail to get into this episode to explain all the various power grabs that were going on. But initially, the empire gets split into five separate kingdoms, which were not really ever reunited again until the age and conquests of Napoleon.
Yeah, which is late 1700s.
Yeah, and if you now remember, Charles the Fat at that time was the only adult male heir remaining alive in 885, but there was another, and his name was also Charles, because, you know, everybody needs to be named Charles or Louis in France.
Much like William Edward and Henry in England.
Yeah. So he goes on to be known as Charles the Simple, and the epithet Simple best translates like he was straightforward, not necessarily right. Like, you know, simple-minded. And he was born in 879 to the West Frankian king Louis the Stammerer. When Charles the Fat is exiled, the West Franks elect the Count of Paris named Odo to the throne, and he rules for 10 years until his death, and then finally Charles the Simple is deemed to be old enough and becomes king.
Yeah, and during his early rule, he added please help me with this name.
Lotharingia.
Yes, to West Francia through the support of their noblemen. Now, at around the same time, he made an arrangement with a Viking invader named Rollo. You may have heard of Rollo because he was a great figure in history. Rollo was granted the Duchy of Normandy in return for his fealty and conversion to Christianity, and he took a Frankish daughter, Gisela, who may have been a younger daughter of Charles the Simple, as a wife in negotiations. When his first wife died without a male heir in 917, he married Edgifu, who bore him a son named Louis. Now, however, Charles became unpopular and lost the support of his nobles, and he fought against rebels, lost, was imprisoned, and died 6 years later in 929. Edgifu and young Louis fled to Wessex and to the court of Edward. And so the next daughter of Edward to discuss is Ealhed, who married Hugh, the Count of Paris. And Hugh was the son of Robert, who was the brother of King Odo of West Francia, who we briefly discussed. And Robert has been given the title Duke of the Franks due to his military prowess and importance. Now recall, this was the title that Charles Martel took to signify his power over the Franks in the Merovingian times. And then after Charles the Simple was deposed, Robert was elected king, but ruled for only a year before his death in battle in 923. These guys die and turn over so quick. That's why the guys who rule for like 40 years, they make an impact. Hugh was offered the crown at age 25, but passed it to Rudolf, the husband of his sister. And Hugh married Edhild in 926. He continued to amass power, land, and riches, though they do not have any children. So Rudolf died in 936, and we'll pick up that story next time. So finally, talk about the next child. Yes, please pronounce that name.
The next daughter of Edward, the youngest, is Edgith, and she's married off to a gentleman named Otto. So when Charles the Fat was deposed of his rule, East Francia initially goes to Arnulf, who helped lead the coup, or really led the coup against Charles the Fat. Now, he was an illegitimate son of one of the other popular names that we ran into, Carloman, one of the Carlomans in our last episode. And we'll skip past all the details. And eventually there's a man named Henry the Fowler, who's elected king of East Francia in 919.
I'd love to know what type of fouling he did. Like, Henry the Fowler is the worst name we've... Charles the Simple's bad, but the Fowler is even worse.
So he's elected king of East Francia in 919. Otto was born to Henry a few years earlier in 912, which is the same year in which Henry inherited the Duke of Saxony. So by 930, Edgith is married off to Otto, and he is now the heir apparent to East Francia, right? So if we kind of take a step back now, in the year 935, we've got Æthelstan, grandson of Alfred the Great. He's king of the English, including the lands of the Danelaw, which are loyal to him. Louis, son of Charles, and Æthelstan's sister Edgifu are in exile in Wessex, but he's potentially an heir apparent to the throne of West Francia. Æthelstan's next sister is married to the second most powerful man in West Francia. This is Hugh that we just talked about, who in history is referred to as Hugh the Great. And his other sister, Edgith, is married to the heir of the throne of East Francia. So I think it's really interesting to start to see these dynastic marriages. And now we're having increasing talks of things like counts and dukes and things like that, which, you know, these are terms that, you know, everybody's heard, but we really haven't established what this all means yet to kind of, bring it all home. So to do that, Chris, let's take a quick detour to wrap this episode up with some basic concepts of feudalism.
Yeah, because you see the changing, the power dynamics are starting to form that we will see for the next basically 1,000 years through the count system and feudalism. And feudalism in its various forms usually emerged in locations as a result of the decentralization of an empire. So, especially in the Carolingian Empire in the 8th century AD, it lacked the bureaucratic infrastructure necessary to support cavalry without allocating land to those mounted troops. So, mounted soldiers began to secure a system of hereditary rule over their allocated land, and their power over the territory came to encompass the social, political, judicial, and economic spheres. It's not surprising that the person with the most powerful military force in a locality gets to control everything. However, once the infrastructure to maintain unitary power was reestablished, as with the European monarchies, feudalism began to yield this new power structure, and it eventually disappeared. So, you know, as kings would move in and say, I'm in charge now, you start to see the breakdown of feudalism.
Yeah, that's right. And again, no surprise that it kind of starts in the Carolingian Empire, in the territory known as France. The strongest elements of the tie back to the Roman systems lived, you know, were resident here in France, in the Frankish kingdom. And so even some of that goes back to the notions of, I think we've mentioned the word federati, right? When the Germanic tribes were moving into Rome in the late Western Roman Empire, you know, to try to appease them, they would give them grants of land and in return provide military service. And so this concept of the back and forth between I'll give you land, you give me military service, is really the foundational element for the notion of feudalism.
Yeah, I mean, way back in episode one, we talked a lot about, in the beginnings of the Roman system, the client system. So we're going to focus more on the titles and kind of break down what some of these mean, because we mentioned counts and earls and things like that, because that's kind of foundational to the understanding of feudalism. We'll dig into more how feudalism shaped the legal system later on, but the key concept to understand is that it describes the general system and societal structure of the period. So at a high level, the king would grant lands to nobles in return for that loyalty, military service, and some form of tribute. So that client patronage system that we talked about. So in turn, the nobility may further subdivide land to lower vassals who may have their own arrangements. So they lease the land from the king and then they sublease it to somebody else. So at the bottom of this hierarchy would be the serfs or peasants. Now, this is all really important because that caste system, essentially in England, that really still somewhat exists. Class, it's breaking down now in the 20th century, 21st century, but the position that you held in society was really, really important. And people are constantly fighting for land and position in England. So some of the titles of nobility would depend on the size or nature of their land or their fief. So it's worth noting that some of the land ownership had already evolved and aligned to this model, but in other cases, it followed this notion of being a fief more explicitly. So, Matt, talk about some of these titles.
Yeah, so in general, right, and this gets far more sophisticated and intricate and complex as the centuries progress.
Because the people in power want to create new things.
Subdivide even right. further, right?
So they
exactly.
can give
but,
it away.
But the lowest rank we should be aware of right now is that of Baron, right? And Barons are going to come up very significantly in some of the upcoming episodes here. So Barons held title across one or more estates, and notably, they would have less territory than which a count would hold, right? And within the regions of the count. So Barons may have received land grants directly from the king, but they might have also received it from a count. So the name count, Chris, right, originally comes from the Latin word comes, which really means companion. And that title was used in Roman times for the high ranking officials, sometimes civil, sometimes military. And the French developed this notion of a county, which is, you know, a territory over which a count presides. Now, in England, the equivalent of a count, that word evolved to be an earl. So you've heard of earls. That's really just the English equivalent of a French count. And that is partially derived from the word elderman, which was used in the Anglo-Saxon era, but probably more likely, you know, emerged from the old Danish word called jarl, right? And so counties in Anglo-Saxon England were not called counties. They were called shires, which we've all heard of a shire. So that helps you understand what a shire actually is. It's the same notion of a county.
Yeah, it's interesting that America ended up with counties and not shires. You know, I'm in Marion County. It's sort of interesting how that developed. So the last for today is the Duke. A Duke is sometimes, but not always, a member of the royal family and may rule over a duchy. Now, a duchy in some cases has a degree of sovereignty. A duke comes from the Latin dux, which dates back to the Roman Republic and was expanded as a key role in Diocletian's reforms, where the title was given to the military leader of a province.
That's right. And we just mentioned Hugh taking on the title Duke of the Franks, and Charles Martel taking the title of Duke of the Franks. Like, those were not through land grants. That was really through their military power taking the title of Duke. But as, again, we'll see over coming episodes, and generally speaking, when we start talking about Duke of this, Duke of that, means they're ruling over a duchy, right? Which is somewhat of an independent sub-kingdom of a larger kingdom, or in some cases, it's essentially the same thing as a sovereign kingdom, except that has not yet converted to Christianity. So the ruler has not been anointed or crowned or blessed and endorsed by the Pope to be worthy of receiving the title king.
And where do women fit in all this? Well, you heard that you were part of negotiations. They were not part of this power structure, but they did wield immense power in both their influence over the people that they ruled with, and also as, just basically merging powers, merging these dukedoms, merging these counts and earldoms. Yeah.
And we will see, thankfully, some very interesting and powerful women who wield some significant influence behind the scenes, some incredibly politically savvy. And so we will certainly highlight some of those amazing women as we go through the next few episodes. Well, really, all the rest of the episodes. So that's it for today, Chris.
All right. Well, it was great to catch up and talk to you today. Thank you so much for listening to the History of Modern Politics. We appreciate you being here. If you enjoy the show, please spread the word. And we will see you again in 2 weeks.